Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we had to learn how to undo the booby traps that were set in the system here today.
Yes.
So we were a little slow getting on the upbeat here. But we're back, and we're here. And our job today is to beat the airwaves, well, at least the airwaves and the internet waves, yeah, into submission with economic minutiae. Is that what we do?
Yes.
Drivel.
Drivel, minutiae, dreariness.
Yes. Anyway, well, the personal wealth coach is not only a dribbling economics radio program, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does business in a lot of places with a lot of people, where we advise people on how to invest money and manage their portfolios. And that's not a coincidence. We try to get all of our information from sources that we believe are quite reliable, things like the Wall Street Journal and Barron's, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Bureau of Economic Analysis and lots of geeky places like that.
Conference boards.
Yeah, and stuff like that. And but we don't warranty the information as being absolutely correct, and we're also not giving investment advice, despite the fact we collectively are the advising members of an investment advisory firm. We're giving education on this radio program, and what we say here should not be considered to be investment advice. Investment advice is stuff that you get on an individualized basis from an investment advisor, not generally. Let's see. There was something else in there that we normally say, and I don't remember what it was.
Yes, our views are our own, and our opinions are our own.
They are?
And if we say stuff on here, it's not the voices of anybody else but ourselves. That should be pretty apparent.
I would think that would be kind of obvious. But no. By the way, today, where we are, is Saturday, the 28th of April, 2018. And if it's where you are, Saturday, the 28th of April, 2018, unless, of course, you're on the other side of the dateline. If you're in Japan or someplace, it could be like the 29th. But if it's the 28th or 29th of April, 2018, you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at area code. Of course, if you're calling the United States, it's 1+. And then 254-773-1400, and you can join with us, and you can ask questions, you can make comments, anything to do with investments, the economy, or things of that ilk.
You can ask about other things, but you will only show our gaping ignorance, our massive bundle of unknowledge.
Right, right. We absolutely. The cloud of unknowing, I think, is a spiritual term.
See, I didn't know that. See, do you see what I did with the didn't know about the cloud of
unknowing?
See, that's an unknown unknown.
That's the worst kind. Well, to quote from the beginning of our newsletter this week, our dearly beloved S&P 500 stock index closed out the week with a decline of 0.01%.
Massive movements.
Well,
the reality is we did have some big movements up and down in the middle of the week.
Well, yeah, but it ended up at 2669.91, which is really close to 2670, which it was at several times.
And there were a lot of people terrified over the number 3 this week as well.
Well, so there's no movement in the stock exchange. And had you watched carefully during the week, though, you would have seen it flirting with 2600 on the low side, and it bobbed up to 2775. And it didn't do much. And if you listen to the news, you would say it should be doing a lot, but it didn't do much of anything.
And the news being that lots of earnings reports came out this week.
Right. And the earnings reports, interestingly, now listen to this. So far, we're seeing a 25% rough, about half the companies in the S&P 500 that are going to report earnings have reported now. And the trend is very consistent. We're going to have about a 25% gain in earnings from last year. However, from last year at this time, the stock market, the S&P 500, is up about 12%. And it's down about 7 5% for 3 months. Now, we're coming in with a quarterly report that, by and large, what we're seeing is record earnings.
7% or 0.7%?
No, 7% down for 3 months.
Okay.
Not 0.7. I mean, it's down 7%. We're well in correction territory. The S&P 500 3-month trailing return is down 7.06%.
Or at least we're in down territory. We're out of the correction if we're not down 10%.
Okay, we're... Yeah, okay, but anyway.
Yeah, yeah. 7% is still coming out of it.
From its peak, we're still, I think, down... We may be down 10. I don't know. I don't know exactly. But we're definitely below where we used to be. Now, we're only down a fraction, 0.14% from the beginning of the year. So the market went up earlier in the quarter when everything looked really, really good in January. And although the articles that I've read have said the market is looking for a reason to be down, I think the reason's pretty clear. The president announced the tariffs on steel and aluminum, and the market started dropping, and it has been down ever since. And that works out pretty well. And an example is Caterpillar. And Caterpillar is very, very much a bellwether for the economy and for the stock market because they make big chunks of steel that go around and dig holes in the ground and fill the holes in, which is what you do when you're going to build stuff. And we generally build stuff early on
in growth cycles.
Yeah. And we stop building stuff towards the end of growth cycles. So people stop buying new cats.
Sometimes we stop building stuff after we should have stopped building stuff for a long time. So
that's why all the cat videos are so popular.
Right, Caterpillar took over the internet.
Right. Yeah, well,
or some.
It's not Caterpillar. It's cat. It's
I guess
cat.
Did. The pillar part did.
It just says cat on the sides of the machines, and everybody thinks that cats have something to do with it. But Caterpillar reported a 31% increase in sales from last year. 31%.
You would think that would be good news.
And their stock went down 6.2%. Let me back up. 31% in the quarter.
Yeah.
A rise of 31% in sales in the quarter. And they reported record earnings, record sales, tremendous momentum going forward. They have big back orders. Talking about good news. And, of course, in their stock dropped 6.2%.
Now, let's make this very clear. We're surprised that not totally surprised. It falls in line. But the market making their price drop is not us saying buy Caterpillar. We're not saying that. We don't recommend buying individual stocks. We're using them as you said, as a bellwether. What does this mean?
And buying cats can be hazardous to your long-term health.
Well, we're mixing sheep and cats now.
Okay, well, then we got 3M.
We got bellwether. The weather is a neutered male ram, or I guess ram that wears a bell. So that leads the rest of the flock. So we're saying that this cat is a neutered sheep.
It is, obviously.
Okay, with a bell.
The cat is a bellwether.
But the bell's made of steel, and the steel has a tariff on it.
Yes, and the issue is that the 3M, for whatever it's worth, again, record earnings, record sales. Their stock is down since the end of January about 22%. Again, no coincidence that the announcement of tariffs by the president and the decline in the stock market are at the same time.
And the CEO of Caterpillar came out and said something that was, I thought, very telling. He told us, so that was telling. That's really...
He did, yeah.
And what he said was, yes, great earnings. Problem. Two problems.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, steel just got more expensive. We use a lot of steel. Number two, we're having a lot of trouble hiring people. There aren't enough people for us to hire, so we expect our wages to have to come up in order for us to continue to create stuff, which just says in two areas, their business model is about to get more expensive or already is getting more expensive, which is what scares people.
And at the pretty much the same time, our dearly beloved Bureau of Labor Statistics, part of the Department of Labor, there's actually...
I keep thinking you're about to officiate a wedding when you're talking about the... Stock Exchange or the S&P 500,
well,
and now
are,
the Bureau. It's a dearly beloved Bureau.
I dearly beloved.
I love this Bureau so much.
There's two institutions in the United States government that I really, really like.
And you'd need to be in an institution for liking.
One of them, yeah, is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the other one is Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Well, I like the data they put out. I think I'd probably go insane very quickly working there.
I don't know. I've never worked there. I've never been there. I just really like that they're totally geeky and totally unopinionated. They just simply work off the numbers. Anyway, the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with a... what to a non-economist would look like a really minor thing. Wages and salaries are up 2.9% over this time last year. That doesn't sound like much, 2.9%, except that if you go back to last year and you look how much they were up in the trailing year, it was 1.7%.
Yeah.
And when you go from 1.7 to 2.9 and you consider that inflation wasn't anything like that, inflation was relatively minor and benign over the last year, yet wages and salaries are up 2.9%. This is an accelerating trend. This means that the labor shortage that we have been talking about is finally beginning to show up as higher wages. And that is something that is making the market nervous. Why is that happening? Well, frankly, we mentioned this, I think, last week, that literally every truck driver, at least statistically, in the United States, it's capable of driving a truck that can be hired, has been hired, and they're out of truck drivers.
Yeah, that's beyond the definition of full employment into over full. There's mm-hmm. not enough truck drivers to go around.
So... We had a wonderful jump this report for the quarter in durable equipment purchases, which sounds really, really good till you realize that the jump in durable equipment was all in the transportation sector, and it was in two major areas, airplanes and trucks. Why was there a sudden surge in buying airplanes? Well, because the airplanes that were bought in the first quarter were bought with old aluminum in it. And
yeah, cheap aluminum.
Now aluminum
already imported.
Prices have gone up, and the newer airplanes are going to cost more, so there was a surge in buying at the lower price. Trucks, we talked about that. There's a record-breaking number of new 18-wheeler truck orders in the works across the board because, frankly, there are more shipments in the United States today. There's more stuff, to use the economics term, that people want to put in trucks and ship someplace, and there are trucks to put it in. The trucking companies have not yet officially or unofficially come up with a solution to the number of truck drivers. It costs between $5,000 and $10,000 for a truck driver to be trained to the point where they can actually operate an 18-wheeler. And the problem is that truck drivers historically have been asked to pay for that themselves. I haven't seen it, but I would not be in the least surprised to see scholarships being issued by trucking companies. If we'll pay for you to learn how to drive a truck, if you'll work for us for a certain number of years, I expect that will be somewhere down the road. We'll see that start to be announced because they're bending over backwards now, offering pay raises to truck drivers, and the cost of shipping things from one place to another is starting to rise. All of these things are drivers of something that those of us who've been around a few years can remember called inflation. Now, how much inflation can we have in the society? Well, because of globalization, there's a limit. And a bunch of companies in Southeast Asia particularly are gearing up to help us overcome that limit by putting more exports into the United States. And by the way, as I said, our telephone number is 773-1400, and I think we're getting a call at 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah, how you guys doing? Hey, I did hear you talking about the trucking situation. And actually, I have a brother-in-law who is almost 70, and one of the trucking companies paid to train him as long as he would drive for them for 6 months.
Wow.
Six months.
They're getting desperate, aren't they?
They are. And it, you know, it just goes to show not only is there so much being shipped that we don't have enough trucks, but you got a lot of inexperienced truck drivers out on the road right now.
Yeah, that's a problem. And it's on the other hand, your brother-in-law is 70, and you know that's not exactly. I'm pretty close to that age.
Yeah, the reflexes there are maybe not as good as they were in his 40s.
Well, let me tell you something. He did it for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then he said, "That's good enough. I can check that off my bucket list."
Well, I admire the people who can put in the kind of hours and eat the quantity of calories that I see them eating at truck stops and still haul all that weight around, not counting what's in the truck.
Yeah, and it's a sedentary traveling life. It's hard on your body, hard on your mind.
And it's soon to be a nearly non-existent job. But is the price, one of the big things in economics, we talk about this, is the price of having a driver in the cab goes up, and it's going up dramatically for shipping.
It makes it more and more a better alternative to go to driverless trucks.
Yeah, and I don't know, I actually saw one truck convoy, four trucks. There were actually drivers in each truck, but they were all identical, and you could tell the drivers really weren't doing anything. They were just watching.
They're testing. Yeah. There's another example. Thanks, caller, for calling in. We really appreciate the call. There's another example of something we can show right away. Airbus has had they're calling it the cruise ship of the skies, the A380. Are you familiar with the A380?
Right.
It's their new double-decker. And
one they just slowed down production on.
Well, they just they introduced it in 2000, and they said, look at this new thing. They've been fighting an uphill battle, big uphill battle, because their competitors can sell two or three for the price of one of theirs. So when you're talking about Boeing, Boeing can give you the same number of seats for a third less the price if you just go with more airplanes. So this beautiful piece of new technology that they developed, it was way too expensive, very much like a driverless truck is way too expensive at the beginning of this cycle. And then wages start going up, or we have aluminum tariffs, and Boeing's going to have to start charging more for its aircrafts. So just recently, they slowed down production of this A380, and now they're speeding it back up again because it's suddenly become competitive. The price that's in the airplane, because the tariffs are there, has caused this great big aircraft to be competitive with two smaller aircrafts now. And that's a fascinating area. The CEO of Airbus is going to be changing at the end of the year, and that's usually kind of a somber thing for the existing CEO. You really don't see him in public without a big smile on his face since the tariffs have been announced, though. So that really says something about what we're doing to American business when we put tariffs on imports to the United States. We're interconnected now. I wish it was as simple as putting a tariff. Man, I wish there was an easy answer like that. That's not how you save jobs. It's how you lose jobs. Anyway, that's enough of that subject. Back to trucks. Tesla's got a very large number of orders. Their backlog is getting big, and they haven't announced recently how many they have backordered. They announced a year ago, and it was a pretty large number of their driverless trucks. And they're looking at doing driverless electric trucks into the future. And this is the kind of transition point. You know, people were talking about how do you transition from gas-powered things to electric? If you need all this infrastructure in place, you need to make all these shifts. Well, if the expense of keeping gasoline is associated with the expense of a driver, and you look at the expense of going driverless and the long-term benefits there, the infrastructure is going to follow the cheapest way of doing things. That's how the economy works. This is important for everybody to understand. When Henry Ford selected gasoline as his method of combustion, he didn't do it because it was a high-priced item. He did it because it was a byproduct of refining kerosene, and nobody was using it. So they got the corner on the gasoline market because nobody wanted it. And now it is the most important factor in the oil industry is the gasoline side of things. Heating oil is nice and natural gas is kind of cool, but gasoline is the thing that drives the oil market. You throw that together with the original intent of nobody's using this, so let's use it. The infrastructure builds itself. It's not autonomous. People are saying, hey, there's a good deal here. I'm going to put in a filling station because everybody wants to buy gasoline. When we've got batteries that are efficient and charging stations that are efficient enough, then, you know, the downtime in recharging a truck battery is less than a night's sleep for the driver. So keep that in mind when we're going forward with this concept of driverless trucks.
Let's see what else is going on in the big wide world out there. I mentioned the fact that the Treasury note, the 10-year Treasury note, which is kind of a benchmark for interest rates, was at 3% for a little while on Wednesday before it dipped back. It ended at 2.96, which is still
0.04% right off of it. Yeah,
and that is again, it sounds like esoteria.
It's a round number. People like round numbers. They like to either be afraid or happy over round numbers.
When you consider that 18 months ago, the 10-year Treasury was at what, 1.26%. This is a more than doubling of the interest rate that is the benchmark for all other interest rates that we use in the United States in a little over 18 months. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. And one of the things that we do and have a lot of fun with other people doing, it's a great game in the economics and investment world, is try to figure out why interest rates are going up when they go up. One reason, obviously, is that there's an increase in borrowing demand. And there is a major increase in borrowing demand, mostly from the United States government. And the more borrowing demand there is, the higher interest rates go and the lower the Treasury securities get in price.
Now, let me explain that in a second. This is an area that I have heard the most people expressing confusion about. So imagine for a moment that you have $100 in your pocket, okay? You have $100 in your pocket, and you have a friend that walks up to you and says, hey, I know we just met not that long ago, but you know I have a job and so on, and I would like to borrow $75 from you. I'll pay it back next month. And you say, hey, this is pretty easy gain of my money. I'll charge you, you know, a few interest points, we'll call it 6 or 7%. You owe me $5 at the end of this. And the guy goes, okay, I'll pay $5 for that. Well, in the middle of the conversation, before you say, pay me $5 and I'll give it to you, another friend walks up and says, I would also like to borrow $75 and I will pay you more for it because I really need it. Look around. I've got a good job as well. I would like to borrow the money. Well, now you got a bidding war going on. It's like an auction. Now suddenly you can say, well, how about $7? Can I charge you $7 for this? That's demand going up for the same supply. You've got $100. If two people want to borrow $75, it's really hard to loan $150 if you only have $100. So you charge more for your loans because more people want them. When demand goes up on interest, it makes... on loans, it makes interest rates go up. It's profitable for banks. It is it's a nice feeling for the bank. But it's also one of the contributors to inflation because it's the same money you could have borrowed last year for a lesser cost. So there's extra money in the system all of a sudden. You're paying money back to the bank. It's an inflationary trend. And the Federal Reserve's job is to raise interest on the banks at the same time that the banks are raising interest on people that are getting loans. That helps to funnel some of that inflation out of the system. Anyway, that was the, so we're back to the 3%. There's a lot of demand out there. People, the U.S. government's borrowing money, and now back to you.
The U.S. government is going to have a deficit this year of about, last I read, the official estimates are $830 billion, which is closing in on, and within 2 years, they're expected to hit the $1 trillion deficit mark.
Right, right.
And that means that in addition, there's a couple of things happening here that are going to probably affect interest rates. And we're trying to figure out if we look at the Treasury and interest rates going up in general. One of them is within 2 years, and this is looking down the road, it's an important thing to consider if you're thinking about buying a bond. And apparently a lot of people did buy bonds. It was a huge $25 billion movement into bond funds in the last, what was it, the week?
Week over week.
And 65 million came out of, or something like that, a very large amount of money came out of equity funds in the United States. And these are retail investors, people generally with 401ks and so on, pulled money out of equity funds and put it into bond funds. Well, this is an important thing to recognize. The United States government is about to borrow a lot of money within the next 2 years. A lot of the roughly $1 trillion that the United States borrowed in the last 3 months, and that included not only deficit, but rollover from previous borrowings, is focused, and the vast majority of it is in two-year notes, which is why the two-year note interest rates went up rather dramatically compared. They're like 2.44%. What's that mean? Well, that means that 2 years from now, in addition to the roughly $1 trillion of new debt the United States needs to generate to cover its deficits, there'll be a second $1 trillion that rolls over. So there will be, about this time 2 years from now, a $4 trillion need, or a $2 to $4 trillion need to borrow money. That's going to run interest rates up rather dramatically. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask you, when the United States government prints money to be recirculated to the states, what is their decision on how much money they're going to print out, and the old money that's out there, what happens to that? And if the United States government can print money, why is it that they don't just print out enough money to get themselves out of all this mess they're in and money they owe? Thank you.
All right.
That's a good question.
Really good question.
The point, first off, it's really important to understand that the money that is printed is a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the money in circulation.
You can say tiny a few more times.
I mean, it's itsy-bitsy, tiny, itsy-bitsy, like you wouldn't notice it.
Okay, your average listener right now, which all of you average listeners, by the way, are way above average. I think you should all know that, because the fact you're listening to this means that you're way above average in something wrong with your brain. You're listening to this program, or something right with your brain. I don't know. Depends on who you ask. All right. So in your pocket right now, you may have a billfold, a wallet, some kind of contraption to hold plastic or paper. You probably hold a lot more value in plastic than in paper. That is the way of things these days. This is an anecdote right out of one of the series that I've watched recently, is comedians and cars getting coffee, Jerry Seinfeld. And he talks about how when he gives someone a $50 bill, they scrutinize it. They hold it up to the light. They mark it with a marker. They flap it around. And he says, come on, guys, we're already believing the myth that money is worth something. What are you doing here? That's the reality. Paper money is pretty rare now, particularly in larger increments. And larger increments start at $50. People start looking at that money and saying, well, we don't see a lot of that because most of it comes either through a debit card or through a credit card, sometimes through a wire transfer. Cashier's checks are kind of disappearing too. So when the U.S. Mint, which is under the Treasury Department, prints money. Why do they do it? You want to say this or you want me to say it?
Well, there's a demand. The banks come along and say people want a certain amount of cash.
Right.
And by the way, here's a bunch of cash that's all worn out that we're sending back to you, and we want new cash.
Specifically, which banks?
The Federal Reserve Bank.
There we go. All right. So we got the Federal Reserve Bank.
Banks, yes.
The U.S. Mint prints money on request from the Federal Reserve to replace money that has been damaged or that is worn or – go ahead.
Well, you know, when they have to take money out of circulation to print it. I know that sounds a little strange, but most money is in the form of little electrons flying around on
hard drives sheet. And clouds and stuff.
And so the Treasury – you would think this is a little strange. This Treasury literally right now has to borrow, generally speaking, has to borrow money, issue Treasury securities, borrow the money in order to print paper money. So you can't, and that's the way the law is. And it's a pretty good law because if you said the United States government could print money.
They can.
In fact, they don't create the money. The Federal Reserve does.
Right. That's part of the Federal Reserve Act.
And the Federal Reserve can create money. It did during the recession, as a matter of fact. It just goes out into the public markets, and it purchases bonds. And when it purchases bonds, it exchanges a bond, which is just a piece of paper that says, I promise to pay you something in the future, into cash and flushes cash into the system. Could the United States Congress pass a bill telling the Treasury by fiat, just say, create a bunch of money and pay off our debts? Yes, they could.
And it's happened in the past. In the United States, it's happened multiple times.
We did that almost exactly 100 years ago, following World War I. The Congress got this brilliant idea. They started in the House of Representatives.
Right.
That we borrowed all this money to fight World War I, and since we print our own currency, why don't we just create enough money and use it to pay off our debts? Well, actually, we did it twice before. We did it once during the Continental Congress. And
we did it another time as well with the specie circular. We just didn't call it the same thing.
Okay, so the issue is, yes, the government did. But what happened is the value of the dollar, we had 300% inflation in 1 year in 1918.
It's called devaluation. It's what Venezuela is doing right now.
And it really screwed everything up for a long time thereafter, because if you have, again, we're talking about this $100. Let's say you have $1,000 in cash, and your $1,000 in cash suddenly only will buy what was previously $300 worth of stuff, because the prices of everything tripled overnight.
What
would make you really, really, really unhappy. And it made a lot of people unhappy after 1918.
Right. What prevents it from happening just off the cuff right now? What prevents the executive side of government, the president or the Treasury Secretary, from saying, just print a bunch of money right now? Is the Federal Reserve Act. This is the thing that the Federal Reserve was created to prevent. Their job, primary job, they've got multiple primary jobs now, but their initial primary job, still one of their primaries, to protect the value of our currency.
Mm.
If we pay off our debts by just making new currency, then we have to take the Federal Reserve out of the system in order to do it. So Congress would have to pass another law that said the Federal Reserve isn't the one that determines the money supply anymore. What's more important in here that's missing? This is an important, really, I can't emphasize this enough. Money right now is not created by the government, in large part. The government creates money in the mint. The Federal Reserve creates money to some extent by, for instance, buying up loans at more than their value. If somebody has just given a loan to someone else and then the Federal Reserve buys that loan from them for more money than it's worth, that's created new money in the system. They took it off their ledger books and put it back into circulation. That's new money. That's kind of what happened during the recession, only most of the things they were buying was they were buying below the face value. Still called printing money. Okay, so where am I going with this? This is a good question. The bank, when it makes you a loan, whatever that loan is, even if it's a credit card loan, if interest is paid on that loan, a small amount of money was just created in the economy. It had nothing to do with the mint, had nothing to do with anything else. If you just borrowed $100 and you pay back $105 to the bank, where did that $5 come from? Well, you had to earn it. Well, now the bank has received $5 for having $100. If you think about that for a second, that is the nature of creating currency. The reason why we had a deflationary trend coming out of that recession is because a lot of people defaulted on their loans. So the bank gave $100 out and maybe got $80 back. That means $20 disappeared. That wasn't in the system anymore. That's the primary way that money is created and destroyed in the United States, is through the function of loans. New businesses do a little bit, new house production does a little bit, but it's primarily focused in loans.
The creation of a new house creates more value in the economy.
Right.
The job of the Federal Reserve
creates
value, not money. It is to create money through the banking system to match that increase in value. For
Correct.
Instance, if the gross domestic product of the United States, which was just announced this week,
2.6.
Grows at 2.6% on an annualized basis. So one quarter of 2.6 more stuff has been produced in the United States. Then the Federal Reserve's job is to increase the money supply by 2.6% so that we don't have, that would mean zero inflation. In
right.
fact, they're working really hard at getting the banks to increase it about 2% more than that. Not so, so that instead of, let's say for the year we have 2.6% gross domestic product growth, the Federal Reserve wants 4.6% more money in the system. And the reason is, if we anticipate a little bit of inflation, about 2%, we tend to buy things now rather than procrastinating waiting for lower prices.
Right. If you think about, if you're buying a flat screen TV, this is an example we use a lot. Right now, you look around and say, it's April, I could wait for Christmas because prices are going to drop for sure. That's when the sales are.
Mm-hmm.
That's a deflationary trend.
Except that recently the prices have been jumping up.
Right. And as the prices are jumping up, that attitude would cost you money now, because you could look up and say, oh, it's going to cost me more if I wait, which means you do the transaction now, which is a better thing long term. It means people get paid rather than less money for doing a job.
What happens in a depression is everybody puts off buying stuff.
Right. And that causes prices to have to come down. Say, nobody's buying this stuff. It's not coming off the shelves, so I need to lower prices. So that when people do buy stuff, you have less money than you thought you would, which means you have to lower the amount you're paying your employees, which means they have less money to buy stuff too. It kind of spreads out through the system very quickly through ripples of saying, we had to lower our prices, therefore we had to lower our payroll. And the people that are buying the things because their payroll has come down, they say, I have less to buy with, so you better lower your prices some more because I can't afford it anymore. So deflation is more dangerous than inflation. And unfortunately, we can't continue this conversation right now. We have to play some commercials. We will continue on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join in the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And volume differentials in here are certainly interesting.
Yes.
Hey, the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. Let's talk about the GDP. That's a new band, isn't it?
I thought it was some kind of a disease. Did you get GDP? Mine came back negative.
Well, the gross domestic product for the fourth quarter, the annualized rate, when they
2.3 is the real growth. Yeah, go ahead.
For the fourth quarter was like 2.9.
Yeah, I wasn't arguing with you. I'm saying the real growth, we were saying 2.6 for this quarter, this last quarter. The real inflation-adjusted growth was 2.3. And I said it in the middle of your sentence. I'm
really?
Sorry. Yes,
I thought it was 2.6.
The
oh, yeah, 2.3. Yeah, 2.3. You're right, you're right, 2.3. So it was 2.3. It was 2.9. And I think that in there, but for the previous 3 months, now previous three quarters, in other words, if we go back a year ago and look at sliding forward till the end of December, the United States economy grew at an annualized rate of 3%. The problem is that we just had a slowdown to 2.3%. And where was the slowdown come from? Well, one of the things that a lot of people have commented on his first quarters have historically for the last several years been unusually slow for some reason nobody can figure out. It's actually pretty easy to figure out. We have big blizzards in New England, and they have blizzards in Europe, and we weren't getting those big blizzards before the polar ice cap largely melted, which, by the way, I know that sounds crazy that cold weather comes as a result of the temperature of the globe warming, but the bottom line to it is you got a lot of water up there, which causes and a lot of cold air, and when it comes south, it has a lot of water in it, and it snows, and you get big blizzards. But we look at the first quarter, and we look at the fact that during the first quarter, we had this massive tax cut, and one would expect to see massive growth in the economy because we had a massive tax cut. And if you have a massive tax cut, you put a lot more money in people's pockets collectively, although individually it's a small difference in your paycheck. You put more money in people's pockets so they can go out and spend more money. But at the end, and corporations got some big tax write-offs, a double whammy. They got the fact that their taxes in general dropped quite a lot, went from an average of around 35% to 21%. But the big one was they got what we used to call Section 179 write-offs. In other words, if they buy equipment, normally if the equipment is supposed to last for 5 years or 10 years, they had to take the tax write-off over the time period that the equipment gradually wore out rather than taking it all up front. Well, now they can take it all up front. Big tax advantage. One would expect a lot faster growth from that. Well, what actually happened was sort of interesting. Consumers are fickle, and about 70% of our economy is consumer-driven. In other words, when you go to the store and buy stuff, that generates economic activity, and that's about 70% of what makes our economy tick. We are unlike Germany or Japan or China, where most of our economy is generated by trying to get somebody else to buy something in some other country, which, by the way, is a good deal for us. If we can generate most of our economic activity internally, that's a lot easier than trying to convince other countries to buy stuff. Anyway, it turned out that consumer spending only went up 1.1% for the quarter on an annualized basis, which is lower than it has been since like about 2014. Why? Because instead of spending the money, consumers said, oh, we got a little more money in our paycheck. Let's pay off some debts and let's increase our savings. And that kind of surprised people. The other thing...
It shouldn't really have surprised people because that's what's happened in the two big stimulus packages during the recovery from the recession, the Bush recovery stimulus package and then the Obama one, is people saved and paid off debt.
Well, actually, stimulus that works, you give money to poor people.
Yeah.
Because poor people don't save money, they just spend it.
When the tax cuts happened... They happened for everyone, don't get us wrong there, but there were more cuts for higher amounts of money. If you're in a big business, you got a big, big tax cut.
And if you're the more income you had, the bigger the number, lots bigger the number of dollars you got cut off of your tax bill, so that basically the 80-20 rule applied here. The upper half got roughly 80% of the benefit from the tax cut.
Before anybody gets up in arms, if you're left-leaning, 80% of the tax cut went to the upper half, but 84% of the taxes are paid by the upper half. So just keep that in mind.
But people with high incomes when they see an increase, when they get an increase in cash flow, don't go out and spend it immediately. They generally have a tendency to save it, invest it, or pay off debts with it.
Yeah.
And people in lower income brackets, if the tax cut had been slanted more towards lower income tax brackets, it had a bigger economic impact. But there's what we've got is an interesting, but the backside of this, one of the reasons the GDP, and this is one thing that a lot of people overlook, dropped from where it was fourth quarter, is because the trade deficit, actually the federal government's deficit gets subtracted, and the trade deficit, which is part of it, gets subtracted from the GDP for the final number. I won't say that again. If let's just say we had a GDP growth of 3% and we had 0.7% of imports into the United States over exports of the totality of our economy, then it would drop to 2.3% where it was. When the federal government, in the process of doing this tax cut, went out and borrowed a whoo bunch of money so they could give everybody a tax cut.
That's the big reason why we look at the deficit this year. We see a bigger deficit. We expected that even before the spending went up.
So what happened is we spent more, we cut taxes, and that means we had to import a lot of money from someplace else, and imports are subtracted from the GDP. They don't count. So the GDP went down, and this is one of the reasons that we think that fiscal policy in Washington seems a little disjointed, because the tariffs are, at least the stated cause for the tariffs, is to reduce the trade deficit, but the same administration that pushed for the tax cut, pushing for the tariffs, are a tax designed to decrease the deficit, whereas the tax cuts were a reduction in taxes that, by definition, dramatically increased the deficit.
Now, in some ways, this is better for the public opinion of the government. If your taxes are being paid through, in essence, a sales tax, if you buy something that has steel in it or has aluminum in it or a lot of other things now, because tariffs are kind of going through the roof on everything, then revenue goes to the government, and we don't feel like we're paying taxes. We're just complaining that the prices went up. So it's kind of like hiding your taxes inside your paycheck, so you don't really know how much you're paying. Well, this is the next level of hiding, because you have no idea what percentage of the cost that you just paid for a can of soda was actually the tax that goes to the federal government because of the aluminum in the can.
Yeah, and if you were to look at the prices at the beginning of the year of washing machines, flat-screen TVs, things that are imported, and you go back and look at the same prices today, they're higher.
Yep.
That extra cost of purchasing things,
which you pay,
is a tax.
It's being, that extra cost is going to the government. You're paying the tax, but you're upset at Samsung.
And so the point is, and I think this is where the president may be missing it. The issue that it really boils down to is, increasing tariffs and cutting taxes work opposite each other. They're just a matter of transferring the taxes to the people who buy things.
Right. And long term, it's better to have a sales-oriented tax, but doing it in a hodgepodge kind of manner is not a good way of doing it. We're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour. If you would like to contact us and talk to us off the air, we have a local number with voicemail at
254-947-1111.
You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and we'll be back next hour with more of The Personal Wealth Coach.